of Eastern Europe switch back to standard time on Sunday, putting all their clocks an hour back. The Soviet Union follows on October 1st, but the United States and Canada stick with daylight time until October 30th. Britain and Ireland, both members of the common market, except where time is concerned, change back to Greenwich Mean Time October 23rd. Australians change time October 30th, but being in the Southern Hemisphere, they put their clocks forward. It's hard on people who work on international timetables for planes, trains, and boats, but good for the kids who get an extra hour of daylight in spring and autumn evenings to play outside. The clocks go back in most cases at 2 a.m. Sunday, or went back, actually, in all European common market countries, which include Portugal, Scandinavia, Austria, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Albania, and Romania. Switzerland follows the lead of the common market despite protests by dairy farmers who complain the changes upset the cows' milking hours. In Asia, Latin America, and Southern Africa, times never change. Well, it's 2:33 in Stony Brook, and it's going to be that way for a little while longer. You're tuned to Chatterbox. Good afternoon. I'm Eric Corley, and we have as our guest today a voice that that may in fact be familiar to you for saying phrases such as
WUSB, Stony Brook.
Yeah, now that's a familiar voice. That's the voice of Frank Burgert, who in fact was even on the air this morning during
that's
the radio.
That's only one program. Of my phrases.
What else do you say?
That's only one of my... I have more. I have lots of phrases.
What else do you say?
Phrases that are mine, that I use too.
Well, say one of them.
Oh, one of my phrases.
Yes.
The one which is mine, that is mine, that I use.
Well, Frank is thinking about his phrase.
I use all kinds of phrases.
Now, Frank is more than what he appears to be, which, of course, isn't all that much at the moment, but Frank is interested in something that that all of America seems to be getting involved in lately, and that's computers.
That's a craze. That's not a phrase. I have phrases and crazes.
It is a craze.
Yeah.
It's a craze. Right. It's a fad. It's a movement. It's... I don't know what it is. What is it?
Is it still morning?
It's 2:34 in the afternoon,
oh,
actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've been here a long time.
Well, let me start off with a story.
Another one of my phrases.
To sort of get us in the spirit here. Computer scientists using one of the world's fastest computers believe they have found the largest prime number yet, one that contains nearly 40,000 digits. Yes, that was reported yesterday. The LA Times says that the prime number was found using a $9 million Cray XMP computer made by Cray Research in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. You ever heard of them, Frank?
Heard of Chippewa Falls, but not that company, no.
Okay. A prime number is one that has no divisors other than itself and one. Euclid proved that there are infinitely many primes starting with 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, and 17, and going on forever, but there is no formula for generating them. Knowing a prime number larger than all others doesn't offer much benefit to society, nor anyone but a handful of mathematicians, but it is a feather in the cap of the supercomputer that finds it, in this case the Cray XMP. The new prime number, which has yet to be verified, is 2 raised to the 132,049th power minus 1, a number with 39,751 digits. If printed, the number would fill more than one entire page of a newspaper.
Now, so you're not going to read that on that number.
We don't have that number here with us. They didn't send that over. But what's interesting is that they have these new things now called supercomputers. Now, supercomputers seem to be computers times 1,000. There aren't very many of them.
They're pretty big.
They're big and they're powerful. I mean, they move. They can do several billion computations in a second.
They're not personal.
Right? No, they're not personal. Now, that's the first thing I'd like you to get into, is explain to us just what a personal computer is. And let me first of all say that our telephone number is 246-7901. If you have a question about a computer or you want advice, maybe about buying a computer system for yourself or something, we won't tell you what kind to get, but we'll tell you what to look for. Give us a call, 246-7901. Our guest is Frank Burgert, computer expert, I guess, self-taught. Did you take many lessons?
I just bought a computer one day, and then...
What made you decide to go out and buy a computer?
Well, it started a long time ago. I don't know. I guess in it must have been junior high school when the school I was at heard of this new innovation, and the math department bought this old Model 33 teletype, you know, the old ones that you see in Western Union offices. Mm-hmm. And they go very slow.
The kind we used to have in the newsroom. That's
even an older one. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then they moved up a little bit more and they bought a more modern one. This one had a phone dial on it. Mm-hmm. That was intriguing. Yes, I looked at it and said...
What was the phone dial for it?
So you could dial up what was called a time-sharing service at that time, because computers were very expensive back then, and they really didn't have, you know, anything equivalent, anything near the microcomputer they have now, or even the mini-computer that was back then, and they only had the big, what was called a mainframe computer. Maybe I should get into what...
Yeah, what is a mainframe?
You can... pretty much break computer systems down into three basic areas as far as size is concerned. Maybe four now that they're coming out with these supercomputers. You know.
Let's put the supercomputers right at the top.
Let's put them way at the top, right? Yeah. Then you go into what's called a mainframe computer, basically made by big ones like IBM, UNIVAC, you know, very expensive. You're talking in millions of dollars.
And they're very big, too. They fill up whole rooms.
They're very big. The peripheral devices around them are pretty big also. They are getting smaller than as technology improves.
By peripheral devices, what does that mean?
Oh, meaning printers for printing out things, disk drives for storage, tape drives, card punchers, readers for reading computer cards, which are on their way out.
Why?
Because methods of storing data is becoming more compact. And there really is becoming no need for storing data on paper punch cards or paper tape, because methods of storing data are becoming so much cheaper, whether it be disks or bubble memory or what have you.
Well, I know here at Stony Brook we have a computer called the UNIVAC, and many times people who take classes never actually sit down at a terminal. They just punch out things on cards, and then they feed the cards into the computer, I guess, and that runs the program, but they never actually are sitting down at a computer terminal.
Right. Well, that has changed. Taking the computer center on campus when I first came to this school and I was taking computer courses, the only way to do computer programming for most of the courses, which was able to handle large numbers of users, where you're not actually interactively working with a computer. In other words, interactively meaning you're sitting there, you type something, and the computer immediately answers you and tells you if you made an error or gives you the proper output. It was called batch processing. And the fact that you would sit down at what's called a key punch machine, which would eject these cards that you typed out of your program or your data or whatever you were entering. And, you know, by the time you were done with your program, entering it into the key punch machine and getting all these cards out, you'd have a stack, you know, maybe a foot tall worth of these cards, which would represent what you're typing in. Each card would be a line, a typed line of data. Okay, then you take these cards and you put your name on it or however it was done. I think it was using numbers back then. And within a half hour, they would submit your card deck, and you'd get your printout.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't know what your program did or whether it was right or wrong until you got your printout back. Now things have changed mostly everywhere. I'm not sure of any university that uses key punch machines anymore. But they have terminals. Where you sit down and you see on a video screen exactly what the computer is doing, and it's totally what's called interactive.
A major disadvantage to those cards was...
You lose a card, or they become out of order.
You drop them. They're very heavy to carry around. Mm-hmm. You see people boxes of cards. Right. It's kind of silly when you think they're using computers.
Right.
But does Stony Brook do that at all anymore?
They have, I think, two key punch machines in the whole university, or maybe a little more in various places, but they do not use them for the general student use.
So everybody has access to a terminal now? Does that
They're given access. There are lots of terminals popping, terminal rooms, you know, rooms that have like 40, 50 terminals in them. They're popping up all over campus. Or they encourage you to go out and buy your own and call the computer up on the telephone.
Now, doesn't that put an extra strain on the computer to have all these extra terminals?
No, not really. Well, yes, the more users you have on, the slower the computer is going to work. But the computer system they have here is designed to handle, you know, hundreds and hundreds of users.
Mm-hmm. Now, this same computer system on campus is used both for administrative purposes and for academic purposes. Now, do you see a disadvantage in that?
Yeah, as far as usage, yeah. It's very heavy usage, and, well, it's getting easier to get on a terminal now because they're placing more of them in operation. They are hoping to separate the computer science department with their own computer and just use the big mainframe for administrative functions.
Now, okay, we were naming types of computer systems. Now, we got up to the mainframe. I believe there are two more.
Right, okay, that's the mainframe. The big one that can handle hundreds and hundreds of users, the biggie. The next one down is called a mini computer, okay? Generally, those computers can fit in, a rack of equipment that's maybe about 6 feet high and about 20 inches wide. That's the next step down. Those computers typically can handle between, anywhere from one user to a couple of hundred users. Are used very widely in the business world where, you know, most businesses cannot afford a big mainframe. You're talking millions of dollars, whereas here you're talking more hundreds of thousands and tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
For most business applications of semi-large companies, that is very useful. And it's also used for, like I was saying before, time-sharing systems. When, you know, back in high school when we were tying into this terminal, this computer on this little terminal, we used to dial up one of these mini computers and timeshare off of it. And what timesharing means is simply that many users can use the same computer and the same central processing unit simultaneously, or appearing to be using it simultaneously. Whereas in actuality, it's timesharing, or allowing time on the computer between all these terminals, but it's doing it so fast that you get the feeling that you are using it at the same time as everybody else, since it's responding and sharing its time with everyone else.
Now, you say a mini computer can handle up to hundreds of users.
Right.
Now, that's pretty close to a mainframe, isn't it?
Well, mainframes can handle much more. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. They can handle thousands of users.
They really can handle that many?
They can handle lots of users.
And what's the
It's also much mainframes are much faster, and they can handle much more peripheral devices, much more storage, much more. But the point is coming that mini computers are useful for most applications that require a large computer.
Now, there's one more.
One more is the microcomputer.
Okay, what's that?
Well, you can even go further than that, but we'll.
Well, let's wait for a second.
We'll wait for that. That's what's referred to as a personal computer, microprocessor or personal computer. That is a computer that you can go out and buy nowadays from anywhere between a couple of hundred and a couple of thousand dollars. And the advantage of the microprocessor is, of course, its portability. It can be carried around. It's not much bigger than maybe a terminal, or it's not much bigger than maybe a bread box. People like that comparison.
Uh-huh. They do get that small, though.
They do get that. I mean,
there's a Texas Instruments coming that's very small.
Very small, right.
That's a microcomputer as much as an Apple is, right?
Right, right. It uses the same type of processor. Now, a difference, I mean, you can start talking about technical differences between a mini computer and a microcomputer. By looking at the components that are within a computer or in a processor. For instance, on a mini computer, the medium size type of computer, the things that are included in a microprocessor are broken down into more component parts in a mini computer. In other words, you have a separate, maybe separate whole piece of electronics board for the central processing unit, which does all your handling of all your programs and all the users. Whereas on a microprocessor, it's all in one chip, one integrated circuit, as opposed to being put over many, many different discrete components.
Mm-hmm. So it's really getting smaller and smaller.
It's getting smaller, right? They're integrating parts of a computer that normally took an entire board into a chip.
Mm-hmm.
And that chip does essentially the same functions as the entire circuit board. It may be a little slower, but the technology is increasing now, where they're almost approaching the speed of mini computers, to even the point where you can buy a multi-user microprocessor system. Maybe it can handle between 1 and 16 users maximum, let's say.
Let me just remind the folks out there that we are taking phone calls. If you have any questions about computers or related topics, our telephone number is area code 516-246-7901. And Frank Burgert is our guest, a computer expert. And he'll answer all kinds of interesting questions for you. Now, you mentioned there was yet another type of computer after this one.
We're still talking in the personal computer vein. But the new ones that are coming out are ones basically that are total microprocessor systems that you can carry with you in a briefcase, mm-hmm. in your pocket.
I saw an ad for one last week where you could actually, it was about the size of a calculator, it seemed. You could type up a letter or an essay or something, turn it off, store it, come back to a regular computer and just feed it in, and it would still be there.
Right.
It was a word processor that you could put in your pocket.
Mm-hmm, right. Portable computer, right. It has a, the biggest part of a computer that's a problem for making computers smaller is the fact that you have to have a readout or something that will show you what you're typing and what the computer is typing back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And in 99% of the computer cases right now, that is what's called a CRT, or cathode ray tube, or a video screen. That's the biggest part of a computer. The microprocessor and all its support circuitry is very small. I mean, you're getting to the point where you can fit it in a wristwatch. Not a very powerful computer, but you could.
But it's getting to be powerful.
It's getting to be powerful, yeah, as they get smaller and smaller in integration. Now, the personal computers that are out that are portable have what's called an LCD screen on it. Liquid crystal display is what that stands for.
It doesn't take much power.
It doesn't take much power, and it's not bright like a CRT. It's a little slower than a CRT would react, but nonetheless, it's very small. It doesn't use any power, and it's portability.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see it all leading? I mean, is it going to just keep getting smaller and smaller?
I think they're going to reach a point where it's going to get too small, and you're going to have to use a pin to hit the keys. No, the small personal computers, the portable ones they have out now, taking aside from the ones with the very small keyboards, they have normal size keyboards, normal size keys that you can type on, and as far as a useful computer that you can use portability, I don't think you can get any smaller than that as far as physical size. They may bring down the size of the components. They may expand the size of the screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you can expand, I guess, is the storage capability.
Storage capability, right. As far as the physical size of it, I don't see it getting any much smaller than the way it is now without becoming impractical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to be able to... with the advent of bubble memory coming into the light of computers now.
Bubble memory, what's that?
Okay, it's a type of memory that's what's called non-volatile. In other words, you shut the power off, and it does not lose its memory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can turn it on in a year, a day, no matter how long, and whatever is still in there. Now, they have systems out now that use... what's called battery backup. In other words, you shut the computer down, okay, everything stays in memory simply because there's a battery there that only supplies power to the memory and keeps the memory alive, okay, while the rest of the computer is off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the computer's still there, and there's still power being applied to the memory. So next time you turn it on, it's there. But the problem with that is if the battery goes dead between the time you shut it off and you use it next, you'll have lost everything that's in memory.
But with bubble memory, you don't have to worry. You can turn
it off.
Right,
it's magnetically held.
Mm-hmm.
basically, you can think of a bunch of bubbles rotating in a tube. And when there's power, those bubbles go through the tube, and they go around in circles, in curlicues, or however they move. And when you shut the power down, they stop. But the bubbles stay in the same place. That's a very simple explanation.
Sounds kind of like the kind of thing you'd expect to find the end of civilization. You know, millions of years from now, people... What, oh, you want to hit that switch?
Can't do it in...
is a test of the emergency broadcast system.
We're just experiencing a test of the emergency broadcast system here. There's nothing to panic. Never happened to me before.
No, this has never happened.
I've been on the air 5 years here, and it never happened to me. Oh, boy. Well, enough about that.
I remember it happened to somebody 3 times in a row on 3 morning shows. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it you?
No, it wasn't me. Mike Girardo, yeah, when he was doing...
Well, believe it or not, we have a call, and that means we have to go into delay. That happened just as I was trying to go into delay. I thought maybe we got fouled up somewhere.
You pressed the wrong
particles
button.
Are being scattered all over time. Okay, let me attempt to do that, and we'll get back to what we were talking about.
This is WUSB Stony Brook. Give us a call, 246-7901.
Here we are, and we're ready for our first call. Our telephone number is 246-7901, and here we go. USB, you're on the air.
Yes. I have a question that isn't basically about specific technical things, but it's about the use of computers as teaching tools. And it's basically, what do you think are the benefits of the use of, or have you thought about it?
Well, computers are very beneficial for learning. You can program a computer. A program can be written for, I don't know, what age level are you talking about? You're talking for small kids or for adults?
Actually, any age level.
Any age level. Well, the advent of all these types of memories coming out and being able to store huge amounts of memory makes it very much more easier for a programmer to create what's called a database of information, and can be very easy to write a program to interactively, and they are out. You can buy packages that are tutorials that will interactively ask you questions, and you answer it, and it'll tell you if you're right or wrong. It'll tell you if you're near right, but that's up to whoever programs that system.
Now I know that there are programs available.
Right.
But
they're used in schools now.
Yeah, I know that there are. There's a lot of a bit of controversy about it at this time. Whether some people feel that it's taking the human teaching experience away from the kids, and I was just wondering if you had some kind of feeling that whether you think that the computer would be taking the human teaching process away from the kids, or do you feel that as things are going now that you see things can be, the computer can be used as well as a teacher to benefit the student, to give the teacher maybe more time to give attention to other students.
Right. Well, I don't think human interaction should ever be eliminated. that would be very detrimental if that would happen. The computer can be very useful because it really... To small children or even you know, elementary school, junior high school, a computer, just sitting down at a piece of machinery and having it talk back to you and do things gets people more interested or children more interested in learning. Whereas if they're sitting in a classroom listening to a lecture, they might not be as interested and they might not learn as much.
Well, Frank, what does that say if someone shows more of an interest in a machine than in a human being? Where's the... are the humans not doing something the machine is?
It's just the fascination for technology, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a fascination for technology.
And what about... There is a one final thing. The other argument is that the problem is in the programs at this time, that the programs are being made by computer programmers and not by teachers.
Right.
And sometimes the programs fall short of really achieving what they could achieve if a teacher had made the program themselves, a person who actually does teaching for a professional teacher, rather than a computer programmer. Do you think that they, I don't really know if they have anything now, but do you think that they should start getting programming lessons for teachers initially, so the programs can be done by teachers, and to, it seems that there's a missing link, that the programs are good programs, but they're not always good for teaching, and that the teachers don't know how to program computers. In fact, a lot of times they find the kids are more able to use a computer than the teacher.
Yeah, that's true. Matter of fact, nowadays I've seen where teachers have actually gone to a classroom where students were teaching them how to use the computers, which is really nice. That works out. I mean, it's still human interaction there, which is very nice. And it should, and teachers should work with students, I mean, with programmers, to come up with a package or software package that, you know, will be a little less programmer-like.
Well, now, how come kids are learning more about computers than adults are? Are adults suddenly closed-minded at a particular point and they don't want to learn about new things?
That's a possibility. Teachers are always willing to learn and come up with new methods of teaching and methods of using technology to their benefit.
Mm-hmm. I see. You have any other questions, sir?
No, I don't. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
See you later.
Our number is 246-7901. If you're driving around in the cars, I know a lot of you are, feel free to stop by at a coin box or a payphone, whatever you call those things, and give us a call about computers. Ask us a question, express a fear or anxiety, or tell us an experience you've had with a computer. Now, we were talking about children and how they seem to be on top of things here. And an article that came over the wire, I believe yesterday, refers to buying a home computer. And it says parents tend to rely on advice from their children when it comes to selecting a family computer. According to a survey conducted for a monthly computer magazine for children 10 to 16 years old, about 67% of parents who responded to the survey for Enter said the extent to which their children influenced their selection ranged from some and strong to total. A typical explanation quoted in the magazine was, "The kids know more about computers than we do from exposure at school, in video games, and television." The article said parents recognize children are more experienced and knowledgeable about computers than they are and can steer them through the maze of the computer marketplace. Also, that the computer is viewed as an educational tool and the model selected should be one that best meets their children's needs. Mm-hmm. You aware of that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Well, I think children are so much interested in computers because the technology blossomed in their lifetime.
Uh-huh.
And while they're learning, it came into being. Because I remember, right during, I was in the middle of a high school physics class, not in the middle of the class per se, but in the middle of a course, and suddenly calculators came out, and we were in the middle of learning slide rules, and it just, okay, that's it. Go out and buy your calculator.
And they came down in price. I mean, what were they when they first came out?
I bought my calculator for about $100 and something, and all it did was add, subtract, multiply, and divide.
And you can buy one of those
for
on a cigarette.
$8 less.
Yeah, less than that. Now the same thing is probably going to happen with computers, wouldn't you say? Eventually.
Eventually, yeah. I mean,
it's happening already.
They do have cheap computers now. You can get a computer for $30.
Now, what kind of a computer is that?
Well, it doesn't have. It's just the basic computer, literally. It programs in the basic language and. It really doesn't have that much expansion capability. It's just basically a machine to learn on and then either sell it or throw it away when you decide to move up.
Uh-huh.
But it's a... You know,
are there any particular types of computers that you've been especially impressed with or that seem to be breaking new ground?
The ones that I'm really impressed with nowadays are well, first of all, in the small computer area, in the personal, the ones with the LCD readout where you can carry anywhere and program and then what's called download or upload to another system.
What does that mean, download, upload?
It means to transfer data between computers that are that may not be compatible, or even if they are compatible. In other words, just transferring data between computers. Mm-hmm. In other words, let's say you're writing a report or something, and you're on a Long Island Railroad train, and you're typing it out on your way to work, and you're putting it into that memory that's in that little portable computer you have. You get to work, you plug it into the big computer, and you press a button that says upload, which means to send data from one computer to another, and voila, it's on the big system, and you can do whatever you want with it there.
That's really amazing. Now, that's a lot of... Well, let me first of all remind the folks you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook, and our telephone number is 246-7901 if you have any questions or comments. Now, this is done very often, transferring of data over telephone lines.
Right.
Now, how exactly does that work? How do you make computers talk to each other over telephones?
Well, you do it by what's called... frequency shift keying, or FSK. What it is just, well, computers communicate in zeros and ones, basically, right?
Only zeros and ones.
Zero, that's all it understands.
So everything a computer does is a combination
just
of zeros
and
ones.
Zeros and ones, right. It's either there or it isn't.
That's binary.
It's either on, right, binary. And when you're talking about, all right, if you probably have noticed that there are many types of computers. People talk about 16-bit microprocessors, 8-bit microprocessors, 32-bit microprocessors. What that simply means is how much data at one time the computer can handle, or how many zeros and ones. A bit is either a zero or a one.
Mm-hmm.
It's either on, off, you'd hear true, false, any one of those combinations. But it's either one of two things. There or isn't there. When you take so many bits together, let's say you have an 8-bit microprocessor, that microprocessor handles the data in 8 bits at a time. In other words, it looks at 8 zeros and ones at a time. And those 8 bits may represent a character, they may represent a number, they can represent a lot of things. Now, getting back to how you communicate over a phone, generally what happens is that those zeros and ones are turned into tones of certain frequencies. So a zero might be one frequency, and a one might be another frequency. So a computer communicating over a phone may sound very tone-like. It'll go up and down, back and forth between the zero tone and the one tone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how it distinguishes. Then at the other end, it hears those tones, and if it's using the same type of what's called protocol or way it communicates, it will be able to understand exactly what that other computer is sending.
And that's becoming more and more commonplace.
Right. Just like, well, going back to the bubble memory, the presence of a bubble is a one and the absence of a bubble is zero. Just think of like that tube with the bubbles are going through it. There's a bubble there and there's no bubble here. That means that's a one where there's a bubble, and where there's no bubble, that's a zero. Sounds funny, but that's...
It's interesting that computers go down to that very, very basic thing of either yes or no.
Right.
Everything is either yes or no.
Right.
It's there or it isn't.
Right. Well, just as a note, I was going to mention this before when we were talking about bubble memory. There's a place where it has been used for many years, and that place has been in the digital cockpit recorders for airlines.
Oh, that's bubble memory.
That's digital storage. That's not... Well, the other day I saw on the news, they said they're looking for a voice recorder for Flight 007 like this, and they showed a picture of a voice recorder, and they sat a piece of tape on top of it to make it look as if it was really recording tape, because it's just a red box, basically. And somebody looking, I said, well, that doesn't look like a tape recorder. But it's actually digital memory, and it's very... very impervious to anything, radiation, shock, and that's why they use it as a cockpit recorder.
Now, that the black box that I'm assuming is still sitting there in the Pacific
Probably
Ocean
a red
somewhere,
box.
Red box, whatever
they call it, a black box.
If it sits there for another 1,000 years...
It would still be there.
It would still retain what was on there.
The bubbles are held in place magnetically.
Now, is there a way to alter what's on those? Let's say some of the wrong people found that box and wanted to change what was said. Would that be at all possible, or erase what was said?
Yeah, it is possible, yeah.
Now, how would you do that?
I mean, you can arrange data. That's one thing about data. You can rearrange data in any... Now, I'm sure they have built safeguards into such devices that prevent tampering.
Uh-huh.
In other words, if you open it, a little seal breaks that says warranty void. But I'm sure that it is possible to tamper with it. But I'm sure also they have safeguards against that.
Now, this whole era of data opens up entire new possibilities. Well, one thing, I was watching on the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network today, there was a hearing by the House Science and Technology Subcommittee. They were talking about computer and communication security and privacy. They had this guy, Neil Patrick, who is one of the members of the group out of Milwaukee known as the 414s,
mm-hmm.
who broke into all kinds of computers. Now, one of the things that
innocently.
They... innocently. Yeah. One of the things they were bringing up, they also had a security, computer yeah. security person from the Los Alamos nuclear whatever.
Right.
And one of the things they were bringing up was, how do we treat someone who goes in and steals data? Is it the same as breaking into a warehouse? Is it the same as mm-hmm. actually forcing a lock and going in and
right.
taking something? How do we deal with someone who just copies the data? What is, where does that come in?
I don't.
How
think,
do we protect
you know,
our computers from people?
Right. I don't think the laws are that clear, straightforward now. I mean, I'm sure they're straightforward. I mean, well, why I said the word innocent, because there are also the people who have maybe have been programmers for that company and were stealing money or merchandise through data. Now, that's a crime.
That's internal.
Right. That's internal. Or it could be external, but that was...
Well, it's coming from within, someone who knows the computer.
Right.
Someone who's worked
right.
on it.
Right.
But,
that's computer theft.
Right.
What these people were doing wasn't really computer theft. It was basically for experimentation or just for having fun, seeing what systems they could crack. That's the difference between innocent fun and crime.
I hate to bring up War Games again, but it does pretty much fall into the format of mm-hmm. that film where
right.
someone was just looking around for interesting computers and happened to find one that was very interesting.
And he was playing a game, and he didn't know what game it was playing.
Yeah, the end of the world. Do you think something like that is possible? Where
I don't think so. I think,
you think something
those systems that do have control over any weapon systems, Strategic Air Command or whatever, are not accessible on the normal phone system. You can't just dial up a computer like that.
Are they accessible on any kind of phone system?
They might be within a military phone network that's totally separate from Ma Bell, as we call it, or ATT.
Uh-huh. And there's no way to access it. What if a military person had to access a computer from a remote location? Wouldn't there be a secret way
for him
to do
it? He'd probably have to go through a lot of security.
Uh-huh.
A lot.
Now, of course, with security, there's always
and he'd probably have to go through a real person.
Yeah.
In other words, to get clearance.
There's always one element, though, that you really can't do anything about, and that's somebody telling you what a password is or what an access number is or something. You can't prevent that from happening. You know, once that happens, there's really nothing you can do.
Yeah, well, people have to be more conscious of computer security.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a subscription to, you know, a database service or some kind of news service, you know, you shouldn't leave your password and your account number lying around on a desk where anybody can walk up and read it off.
Uh-huh.
Just like he did during War Games. He was sitting in the office there waiting, and when the secretary went away, he quickly knew exactly where she wrote the latest password.
Uh-huh.
And it was all written down. Quickly opened the drawer, got it down, put it in his own memory banks in his head, and then went home and changed his grades.
He called up the school and changed his grade. Huh?
Right.
Now, I suppose that's possible.
That's possible.
Change your grade somewhere.
Right.
Although I'm sure more attention is being paid to it now than in the past.
Right.
Before I ask you this question, let me give out the phone number one more time. Area code 516-246-7901 if you have any questions or comments about computers or really anything. Now, you mentioned database access and people leaving their passwords lying around. Let's extend our imaginations a little bit. What do you think can happen if someone left his password lying around? What are the possibilities? What kind of scenarios are we looking at? We can change medical records. We've proved that already.
You can do that.
That's Sloan Kettering in New York. They left their medical records hanging around. They could have been destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Because the thing is, the computer has to be easy access for the legitimate user.
Right.
And it has to be difficult access for the non-legitimate user. And if the person who's legitimately using it is careless with his, and is not instructed in proper usage of his password, or as far as keeping it secret, that's his own fault if he's going to do that.
But what kind of things do you see happening? What can people do with computers today if they misuse them?
Well, everything from range of theft of services, in other words, getting information that normally would have been paid for by that person.
What kind of information would that be?
Oh, everything from news to stocks and general information. That's
tying into the stock market?
Yeah, they do. Dow Jones does have a system where you can call up. It's basically just getting information. You can't alter it.
Uh-huh.
They enter it from their computer.
Now, how about things like ordering merchandise, bank accounts?
Right. When you log on to a computer and you have, electronic catalogs, and it knows who you are by the account, you may not be that person. And you can place an order, and that person will get billed on his credit card
and he'll get a
for
box
merchandise that you bought. But the thing is, the problem with that is that it has to be sent to that person's address. And it's really very difficult to steal merchandise. You can order it. He'll get a $1,500 television set in the mail, and he says, oh, wow, where'd this come from? And he'll get the bill a month later, and he'll say, I didn't order this.
Unless he's on vacation.
Then he'd have a problem, yeah.
And the TV set comes to his house, and you just happen to be hanging around,
mm-hmm.
and you see the big UPS truck come by or something, and you give the guy a tip, and you leave in your car with the TV set, and he gets billed a month later.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine those kind of things are happening all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you think could? This is a serious problem. Something obviously has to be done, because this seems like it can throw the entire economy into chaos if all kinds of people access
this. People are realizing that more now, and if something does happen to them, I'm sure they're not going to be careless.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in most cases, companies may be lenient and say, oh, okay, we won't charge you for it, as in private phone systems and
things like
that.
But in effect, they do, because they have to raise their rates because of all the abuse.
Right. The more abuse a company gets, probably the higher their rates will go.
Mm-hmm. So they are, in effect, charging everybody for that.
Yeah, they're deferring the costs over a lot of people,
now,
distributing the costs.
Do you think eventually there'll be some sort of a penalty for people who are careless enough to leave their passwords lying around, or will companies be tolerant of that kind of thing?
Well, I don't know if there should be a penalty other than that their work has gotten messed up, so to speak, because of the problem. Certainly should be reprimanded if it was found out that they were leaving their password lying around. But
now, I've heard all kinds of possibilities, such as having you call up a computer, it takes down information from you and calls you back to verify.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've also heard of things where it uses a voice a pattern analyzer. You
mm-hmm.
have to talk, and if it's the right voice, it lets you in, and only then. Don't know what happens if you have a cold or something.
well, your voice pattern's still the same.
It is, okay.
Yeah, pretty much.
Your fingerprints, things like that for access.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see those things becoming commonplace for computers that you call up from your home computer?
Depends on how high security the computer system is. If there's really... Oh, from your home computer?
Yeah. Well, that's where most of the abuse is taking place.
Right.
So that's where they're going to have to put in these extra safeguards.
Yes, true, right. And just general training of personnel who are using the system would also help.
Where do you see computers coming in and doing the most good in a place where they're not now?
Hmm.
I know they're being used for traffic lights.
Yeah. You can... you can think of almost anything and probably come up with a computer application for it.
Okay, let's think of something.
Think of something, just something.
Yeah, anything.
Well, you can take the radio station.
All right, let's take the radio station. There are radio stations that are computerized already that do not have human beings running them.
Right. Somebody has to sit down at the terminal and say what music goes on and what commercials go on. You know, you may do that for the entire week. You know, a secretary might be doing that.
Uh-huh.
And then you just sit back and the computer will run the radio station. We'll turn on the tapes. We'll, assuming that they're in the right places, they have to be humanly loaded.
Uh-huh.
And there are a lot of stations like that. If you hear a lot of beautiful music stations, listen to them very carefully. You'll notice that they follow the same exact pattern time after time.
In other words, 14 minutes of music followed by a commercial.
2 minutes of commercial followed by a station identification, uh-huh, followed by another 14, and repeating the cycle over and over again.
I see. Now,
that's called robot radio.
How long has that kind of a system been in effect? Is that something new?
Well, it hasn't been all computerized. I mean, it's been... right now, the new automation systems they have out for radio stations are basically terminal-oriented. You type in the information, and it will take over from there.
Mm-hmm.
Older automation systems have been in use for years and years, going back to the 50s, around there, they came into being. And the older systems are mechanical. There are these little... Mm-hmm. motors that turn clocks and these little cams that turn around, and they, each time it comes around to a certain time, it hits a switch. The switch turns on a tape.
Uh-huh.
It's basically a computer, yeah. It's following logic, but it's mechanical logic as opposed to electronic.
And mechanical logic tends to break down a lot more.
Wear out, yeah.
And wear out, too.
Chips don't wear out too much. There are no moving parts.
Do they wear out, though?
They might burn out if adverse conditions are subject to them, or they are subject to adverse conditions, rather.
Okay, so we have radio stations run by computer. With TV stations, are they run computerized?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Uh-huh.
Most TV networks are run by computer. Every second of the day is accounted for in a computer, and it knows exactly what to switch to at different times of the day.
All right, well, then
how... If you've ever watched a network station or something, you may have occasionally noticed that... commercials get cut off before they've ended.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
ask you.
That's because maybe the tape wasn't queued up right to the beginning of the commercial, and there was a little blank space before it, but the computer doesn't care.
Uh-huh.
The computer says at 4:57:30, that commercial gets cut off. It gets cut off.
And the commercial after... I've seen strings of commercials get all messed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it just gets off by a few seconds in the beginning.
Uh-huh. And then there are these long periods sometimes where they just have nothing on the air.
Right.
What's happening there?
They're trying to override the computer. I mean, they do have methods of overriding the main computers to get something on the air quickly.
Okay, is that getting harder, overriding the computer? It sounds kind of frightening. The computer is doing something and you want it to stop, and you have to convince it to stop.
Right. Well, software programmers are building in more safeguards against that as far as, the old movies about the computer, if a computer goes haywire, it starts spitting out paper all over the place. I mean, that's not real.
But it can be programmed to do that.
Yeah, I bet it can, yeah.
Now, that's you brought up an interesting point. The actual physical movement of objects, I guess we're talking more about robots now.
That's another field that's...
Okay, how do computers tie into actually, say, turning on the heat in the house or moving an object from one part of the room to another?
Mm-hmm.
Are computers capable of doing that kind of thing? Or are we talking about robots or what?
For moving things around the room, yes, you're talking about robots. For control of appliances, heat, lights, I mean, that could be done with a current... microcomputer rather.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, I mean, you can buy appliance controllers that plug into the wall and plug into your computer.
Uh-huh.
And the computer can control whatever that may be. You can be 100 miles away from your house and there's a terminal, and you can call up your computer over the telephone and say, I want to turn on my kitchen light. And somebody has written software to do that, and you say, okay, select one, kitchen light, bathroom light, hallway light. Do you want me to turn it on or off? And you say yes or no or whatever, and it will do it.
Does this exist now, or is this going to
exist? Oh, that exists.
You can
buy systems like that. You can buy controllers.
And they control anything electrical in the house?
Anything electrical.
Now, I guess that also means that someone else, if they found out your password and your number, could call up and turn on your kitchen light and probably...
Yeah, turn on your blender and coffee pot. Well, we used to do that here at the radio station. When we were building the station, we had a remote control of a coffee pot. So whenever we would come in the morning, we'd call up a phone line and enter a code, and a coffee pot would turn on. So when we came into the station in the morning, there would be coffee waiting, provided that you put coffee in the pot and water in the pot the night before.
Now, on a kind of a larger scale, I guess you could also call up a computer and turn on a radio transmitter or turn off a radio transmitter.
They have that already.
Oh, boy.
But it's, of course, you know, there's a security system you have to go through to... First, you have to know the number, then you have to know the way to get past the security system.
Uh-huh.
But there are radio stations that are remote controllable by telephone.
Uh-huh.
I know of some. I've seen some in operation. What it does is it'll leave you... Well, there are a lot of radio stations where the main engineer may be very far away from the station. And if the station goes off the air... he has to travel maybe 50 miles to get there, and the station may be off the air for that period of time.
Uh-huh.
And it may be a simple problem that he can solve at home. So he can call up his transmitter by his computer and get all the parameters of that transmitter, or it doesn't even have to be a radio transmitter, it could be anything,
uh-huh.
and see what the situation is via computer, and then possibly even correct the situation by remote terminal.
We have about 6 minutes left, so if you want to give us a call, it's your last chance. Area code 516-246-7901. We're talking about computers and technology.
Robots.
Things like that. Robots. Robots are really fascinating. Are they starting to be developed? Or are they...
Are available for consumers now.
What kind?
Robots primarily in the past were used for assembly line type work at factories. You know, it would pick something up and install a part, move to the next one, and do the same thing over and over
again. One thing.
Robots are getting more dexterous now in that they can actually recognize objects to the fact that, let's say you have a square box and you ask it to pick up the square box and then you quickly move it on it.
Uh-huh.
It will say, there is no box there. You moved it on me.
Will it look
and
for it?
And then look for it.
It will look for it.
Yes.
Now, I've heard of robots that can actually look for a person in a house and tell him something.
And recognize that person's voice and talk back to it in a synthesized voice.
I see. Now, how does it do that? How does it find the person? Does it have eyes?
Possibly. Or it might find any person. It might not be able to distinguish a particular person.
Uh-huh.
But it, you know, can use a heat-sensing device. Can sense body heat, or they do have robots with eyes, cameras, that can sense objects. Right now, it can basically sense shapes and movement.
Now, how fast can robots eventually move as fast and as easily as humans, or do you think they'll be always kind of clumsy?
They'll always be clumsy, maybe not always. Maybe one day they'll come up with a with a robot that has feet and hands and can walk.
Uh-huh.
Well, robots can walk now, except they're on wheels, and
well,
if they get a flat tire, they have a problem.
One thing I'm kind of having difficulty understanding, a robot is something that pretty much does a task, but you could say, you know, a tape recorder is something that does a task. What's the difference?
A robot is doing something that's a little more dexterous.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a tape recorder, it records sound, but it can't pick something up and move it. It can't.
Well, in effect, it is. It's picking up tape and moving it to another part.
It's not manufacturing something.
It's not manufacturing. Is that the definition of a robot, something that manufactures something? What I'm saying is the simple things that have existed for a long time, this century anyway, aren't they in effect robots too?
Well, a robot is basically, I would say, something that does something that a human could do, except doing it mechanically. A tape recorder is something that a human can't do. You can't talk to me, and I can't play back in your voice what you just said. I can pick up this box here on this table and put it down over here, a foot away. A human can do that. If you program a computer to do that, you can call it a robot. It's doing something that a human would have done or could have done.
So that's when a computer becomes a robot, when it actually does something physical.
Physical, or anything that a human can do, to the point that it can recognize. I mean, a robot doesn't have to move. It could just sit there being looking at something and recognize objects and things going by. A person can do that, too.
So when do you think robots will start coming into their own? And well, will they the same way
in manufacturing? They're very, very widespread now.
Okay, but I'm talking about in consumer markets, in the house. When will you see personal robots?
Well, they have them now. It's probably more towards the hobbyist end right now. There's people playing with them. Give it 20, 25 years. And
that long?
Well, I don't know. To be a commonplace thing as a television set is probably going to take that long.
Now, what kind of things do you think people will abuse robots with? Do you think there'll be robot hackers that will go out and make other people's robots do things for them?
Well, you have that problem with garage door openers now.
You do. That's true. And remote control TV and also portable phones.
Right.
You kind of cross.
Of course, you're going to have it. It's probably going to be all innocent fun.
How is it going to recognize a command? By a voice, by a password, by what?
Voice or keyboard entry.
So it's going to have to recognize somebody's voice, because if you say to do one thing and someone else says to do another, it's just going to burn out right there in front of you, not knowing what to do.
It'll probably take priorities over one person over the other. Say, that's my master. I will listen to it.
We're talking about slaves then, aren't we?
Yeah.
So
they have no soul.
Perhaps the next century, everybody will be able to have their own slave, mechanical slave.
Wash the floor, vacuum the rug. Household tasks.
Well, do you think that's good?
Probably going to make people more lazy. probably also make some people afraid of technology when one goes haywire and it starts blowing out the dust instead of vacuuming it up.
True. That should be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Do you think it'll change the human concept of life at all?
Well, if they start coming out with androids, watch out.
Yeah. Should be interesting. And let's hope that we're around to discuss this when it comes out.
I hope so, too.
Well, Frank Burgert has been our guest for the last hour here on Chatterbox. We've been talking about computers and robots in the future and all kinds of fun, exciting things like that. And I'm certainly looking forward to the changes that are going to come. And I know you are.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
We're in the middle of a technology upheaval here.
That's for sure.
It's really starting to blossom into a lot more than just a simple computer.
Well, Frank, we'll be hearing from you again as technology progresses, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Thanks for being with us today.
Very good.
Bye.
Glad to be here.
This is Long Island's non-commercial alternative at 90.1 FM in stereo, WUSB, Stony Brook.
Stardate, September 26th. The planet Jupiter may belong to a theoretical class of objects called brown dwarfs. More about it right after this.
Stardate is made possible through an underwriting grant from AP Computer Products. They're located at Computer Headquarters, 1245 Middle Country Road in Selden.
Stardate September 26th. Faint stars called red dwarfs are millions of times more plentiful than giant stars in our galaxy. But even the red dwarfs may be far outnumbered by a theoretical class of objects at the bottom of the star heap. Known as brown dwarfs, these stars exist, at the moment, only in theory. The idea is that some objects may form, as stars do, from huge rotating clouds of interstellar gas.